And they're off. John Hennigan races to the lead ahead of his brother Brad Hennigan. But what's this? Jane Smiley is rushing ahead, proving that you can lead a horse to the racetrack, but you can't make her drink. But the two Hennigan brothers leave her in the dust. Not even a bold surprise can help Jane Smiley. How will the interview go? Brad Hennigan is now neck to neck with John Hennigan, and all this without cortisone. And what's this? A tiny midget horse named Billy Barney has entered the race, and he's rushing ahead of the two Hennigan brothers, Jane Smiley, and even Barbaro himself. This is an exciting race, folks. I do hope somebody bet upon the midget.
Okay, so I am here with Brad and John Hennigan, who are the people behind the first Saturday in May. How are you guys doing, Brad and John?
Awesome, thank you. Thanks for having us here.
Maybe you might want to identify yourself.
Sorry. This is John Hennigan.
And this is Brad Hennigan. Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, thanks for being here. Well, first off, I wanted to ask you, you settle upon 6 horses, not 5, not 7, and I'm wondering how that magical number came about, because obviously you couldn't predict exactly who would make it to the Derby. And so how did you stumble upon the particular trainers? I mean, what criteria did you use, and why 6? Is this really kind of a matter of each of you can cover 3 of them, or what happened here?
This is Brad, and this was the magic of editing. Yeah, we probably ended up following around 13 horses altogether, and we shot over 500 hours of footage. And, you know, going through that, we cut the 500 hours into around a 3-hour epic film. And then we showed it to several people, and we kind of pared it down to 6 horses, because it seemed palatable for people, and people could actually digest 5 or 6 people. It was the horse and the people around the horse. So it's a lot of characters to jumble around. And we felt that that was the magic number where everyone could understand it and everyone could say, okay, I know that guy. I know that guy. So that's how we went to 6.
And we whittled it. This is John. We whittled it down to 7 from you know, a bunch. And 7 was just, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back. So we just lifted out one storyline. And that's when we realized, like, this works, you know. So it was definitely a delicate balancing act.
Well, this explains the VH1 pop-up video captions throughout, because I was saying to myself, well, you know, I can kind of keep track of 6 people. I'm wondering if there was, in this longer 3-hour cut, the pop-up video was applied because you had 13 people you were following. And maybe you can talk about also how you got down from 13 to 6. What kind of balancing act did you use here to make sure that these are the right subjects that depict a variegated landscape of horse racing?
Right. John here. You know, the road to the Triple Crown begins in June, basically, and ends in May. So it's 11 months, and a lot can happen. It's like, you know, a baseball season or another professional sport. It's very long, and, you know, horses, these are young horses, and some of them improve, some don't. A couple get injured, you know, and fall off the trail. It's, you know, kind of like an ebb and flow, so you kind of got to go with it. And, you know, at the end of the day, though, we just wanted to stay with the characters that were the best. You know, if their horses were good, that was great, but we really knew that what would sell this story is the cool people. And that's, at the end of the day, that's what you care about. I mean, because this is a movie really just about people that happens to be set at the racetrack.
Well, who were not the best? Who were the other 7? The Magnificent 7, perhaps, or the Unmagnificent 7?
Well, I mean, I don't want to start naming names. You know, we could have kept them in there, you know, but it's just too much. It's like our goal is to make horse racing cool again and make this like a 101, horse racing 101, and it was too confusing for people. That was the main thing. It wasn't like the stories weren't interesting, because all the guys we were followed were very interesting and had different things going on, but it's the greater good of this was to do a movie about the racetrack that we know, so we could bring more fans into the sport. And we had to just make some tough choices in the edit room. I'm sure any film director or editor you talk to, you have to make tough choices at some point, and that's what we did.
I'm curious if you had considered at one point dropping Barbaro. That would have been a more subversive film, I think, you know, because you kind of go into this knowing Barbaro's going to win, and as a result, you have sort of something of a crazy editing job, because how can you anticipate what a horse racing enthusiast is already going to know in advance, because we all know Barbaro's going to win.
Well, a good example of that is there's a great documentary called, a great documentary about the Olympic, Do You Believe in Miracles, that was done on HBO, and you knew that the U.S. beat the Russians, but, you know, it was done in a way that that it still lent itself to a lot of drama.
Right, and you forget the details, too, of these historical events. They just become bigger than life as the years go on, and we feel like this is going to stand the test of time. I mean, quite frankly, you'd be shocked about how many people really don't know what happened to Barbaro. Mm. Well, I mean, we started asking people, do you know who Barbaro is?
And we probably screened this around 50... I don't know, 50 times.
Yeah, 50 to 60 times in different cities and film festivals. And
you know, a lot of people don't know. I would say about 60% of the people don't know what happened. 60 to 70% of the people, they know that Barbaro is a horse and he's good and he maybe got hurt and he got hurt in the Kentucky Derby. So there's a lot of misconceptions out there about it, you know, but...
And it's just like any documentary, it's just like you go a little bit under the surface, you don't just sit and settle for like the evening news take on it. It's like, this is, we were there, this is what really happened, this hasn't been run through filters. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. That's why, you know, we like the documentary medium.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you mention this, because this could also be a function of the news, which reports the winners or reports a crime, and then... We don't actually find out what actually happens to the criminals or the horse winners. Or I mean, the winners are left to win, and we don't actually track their particular stories. I mean, was this as part of your responsibility as filmmakers with this in terms of the after-Derby denouement of Barbaro?
I think that it's almost felt like well, the name of the film is The First Saturday in May, and you know we've always envisioned that the film was over after the Kentucky Derby, after Barbaro won, we said, you know, we got to move on. Like that was amazing. He won by the most the largest margin in 60 years. So we felt that the story had to go on. So you know, it was I mean, how could you not continue to following him? You know, we had these visions of Triple Crown or this or that. So you know, what happened at the Preakness was you know, something we could not have expected.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, imagine if you're making a movie, and like, imagine if we did this and like, he won the Derby, and we're just like, all right, let's pack it up and start editing, and then this horse, you know, well, like Brad said, we thought maybe he had a chance for the Triple Crown, but he got hurt if we didn't have that, you know.
We'd be the biggest jackasses in the country.
But a lot of people wanted us to go back and recut this and make it all about Barbaro, and we didn't, that was not... anything we wanted to do. You know, we wanted to show, we thought Barbaro was one of six parts of this story. You know, it wouldn't be as powerful, we don't think, if we, you know, eliminated these other great storylines.
Well, this also makes me want to ask you about the element of the media in this. You were talking about the evening news earlier, and you tend to talk to a lot of trainers as they're in the process of being interviewed. And this made me wonder, well, gee, are these guys just hovering around their subjects, and every time they arrive, they're in the process of an interview? And there's also a number of moments in this that I was struck by. For example, the frightening woman who has a cup of coffee and a reporter's pad in her left hand, which struck me as a sort of, wow, I've never seen anything like that. As well as the cutesy Derby thing that the HRTV reporter says. I'm curious how much of the media was endemic to this, or was it just a matter of, you know, the constant influx of reporters that you were trying to fend off as you were trying to shoot these trainers with your cameras?
Kentucky Derby is the most credentialed sporting event. It's bigger than the Super Bowl. I mean, people are, you know, if, you know, you may not be a horse racing fan, you should be, but if you knew how much people are paying attention to this, there's reporters everywhere. I mean, these are the, you know, the Rick Pitinos or the Bill Parcells or the Bill Belichicks, these trainers of horse racing. So,
or the Bill Selfs, since he just
right,
won
Bill
it.
Self won it. But, you know, we also, it was easy for us because when the reporters came along, they asked the questions, we were just flies on the wall. Huh. And we could get out information that way. You know, and it's just to show what these guys go through too. You know,
and, but you know, we didn't set out to use a lot of the reporters, but it seemed like they were, as in the editing room, they were asking questions that, you know, in the very early morning when we're there shooting. You know, there's no reporters at 5 a.m. or 4:30. You know, they start showing up around 7 or 8, and you know, it wasn't our intention to use those, but it was interesting shooting that and seeing how they dealt with the media and the questions that kept coming up and were questions that we thought, as we were cutting, our viewers are probably asking that question as well. And, you know, right. We really didn't want to use a voiceover, and this kind of helped us in that capacity.
Yeah, you know, not to, you know, knock movies that use voiceovers, but I mean, a voiceover is a very weak storytelling device. It means that your pictures aren't telling the story. And as you know, we didn't have Morgan Freeman doing this. I mean, we probably would have liked to. It would probably give us more attention. But, you know, we didn't want to use a voiceover, you know. We can manipulate things quite a bit with a voiceover. Mm-hmm. With, you know, a reporter sticking a mic in your face, that's what you're going to get.
Well, it's interesting because many of the cuts in this movie often begin with a question, whether it's asked by you or whether it's asked by a reporter, and I'm wondering how this came about, because a lot of filmmakers want to remove themselves almost entirely from the equation. Oh, it's magical representation of reality and truth. We had nothing to do with it whatsoever. It's the natural process of reality around us. And so you decided to go ahead and put your questions in there as well. So it's almost this constant probing element to it.
It wasn't like a Nick Broomfield, like we were in there. But I mean, I would say I asked probably about two questions throughout the film, and you probably did about
I've never even thought about what you're talking about right now. I mean, we threw all the rules, not to sound like some kind of maverick, but we really didn't give it that much thought. We wanted to use what were the best ways to get information to the viewer, and the viewer is so media savvy today. Every television station has 19 reality shows. People know what's going on. They know there's a guy there at the camera, so we're like, why don't we leave the good questions in that we need the answers to right there? But yeah, I don't want the viewers to think we're sitting there answering questions the whole time in the movie. Mm-hmm. So we really didn't give it that much thought.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, in terms of the rules, you are two brothers. I don't know how amicable or contentious you both are, but obviously you have to come to an agreement when making this particular film. So I'm wondering if you established any particular ground rules for how you put this thing together. It sounds like it was quite a laborious process here, what with all the hours of footage, the many cuts, the whittling down from 13 to 7. So how did you agree on anything? Or was it a matter of just, Jesus, we got to get this film done by a certain time and get it out, which is really how I see a lot of filmmakers along these lines work.
It's all of the above, basically. I mean, we're just cutting things and making these cuts and see what works. And when we let other people kind of look at that and see, because you bring in your own preconceived notions and things that happen to you while shooting, and you think that comes across in the film. But when people are looking at it cold, you know, they could have a totally different take on a scene. And, you know, a lot of questions were answered by screening it and screening it and screening it. And people either understood a scene or really reacted to it. And that's kind of, how we went about it.
Well, yeah, and in terms of us, like, battling it all or getting in fights, I mean, we shot 95% of this by ourselves. And I would be at a track in New York or Kentucky or Florida, and Brad would be in California or Arkansas. So we're really never together. I mean, it was just us, so that was good and bad. I mean, we made all our own decisions, and we would talk to each other on the phone, but it was just kind of like fly by the seat of your pants, shoot as much as you can, go with your gut type thing. And, you know, then in the editing room, yeah, there's definitely some, you know, you have discussions about stuff, but, I mean, we did how many cuts of this thing? 20-something? I mean, this was definitely not like, you know, we were trying to throw something out there. I mean, everything up there is there for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is the project of our lifetime. You know what I mean? Like we really put everything into it, and I think you'll see it on the screen.
Well, in terms of using NBC footage in conjunction with your own footage, this seemed to me quite interesting. I mean, it almost commands this godlike view of the proceedings, but I'm wondering if this might have, in some sense, taken away from what you both brought visually to this particular film, because if this is a film that is intended to be on a grounds level of seeing the reactions of these various people to their labors and their training and their various endeavors, I'm wondering why go ahead and tamper with that notion.
That's a good question. I mean, basically, We couldn't cover it all. You know, it's usually we were covering one guy at a race, and now all of a sudden we had six in one race. And, you know, we also gave cameras to the children. We gave it to Dan Hendricks, the brother Derek. We gave his son a camera. We gave Dale Romans, the trainer of Sharp Humor, we gave his brother a camera. And then we gave Michelle Matz, daughter of Michael Matz, the Barbaro, we gave her a camera. So we do get this intimate feel, a home movie feel of them walking over to Kentucky Derby. We have their shots in there mixed in with the NBC footage and our footage. And it was, we basically had to do it to get all this coverage. I mean, there's 170,000 people there, 150,000 people. So right. it was something we had to do too.
Well, the other thing is, you know, we talked about this too. We were going to try and just keep it to our footage, et cetera. And then we said, you know what? This is the peak of our movie. This is the Kentucky Derby. I mean, we can't very well get people here and not show them the Derby, you know, because we try to do something artsy and cool. We're like, this isn't working. You have to show the Kentucky Derby and how great this horse did in the race. So, and really there's only, I mean, we know this from getting all the clearances. There's only about 57 seconds of NBC footage in there, believe it or not. Yeah. So,
fair use? Was this the way you got around it, or did you have to really obtain permission for it?
Everything in here is legal and legit. We got a good lawyer, and we busted our tail to do it. So,
and NBC was great, you know, getting us the footage.
Right. NBC has been fantastic. They understood what we're trying to do. I mean, this isn't some subversive document. You know, we're saying, too, documentaries don't necessarily have to be purely socially conscious. We just want to make a fun documentary that people can go out and see, you know, that they don't have to be reminded on the evening news every night that the world sucks and it's bad out there. Mm-hmm. We just want, you know, to have an option at the theater that you can just go see something fun and learn about a new world.
There's a question I have in terms of how you covered the subjects in this. Many of the trainers are seen at the stables, at the tracks, in their offices, but you often don't really go into their home lives. And this was interesting to me. Was this a kind of invasion of privacy issue? Was this a matter of seeing how they operate while they're training their horses? Or why did you refrain from this aspect? I mean, there are a lot of kids in this, as we established here. I'm wondering why you didn't go whole hog here.
It's basically their life. I mean, they're there for 13, 14 hours a day. You know, we did go into their homes, and we did go to you know, follow them other places on the golf course and buying derby suits and so forth. But, you know, they spend, you know, what we say is these guys are really, really hard working. There's no off season. They don't go down and play golf in the winter. I mean, they work 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And they're there at 4 in the morning till 6 or 7 at night. And, you know, we wanted to show that this is their world. I mean, they spend almost every waking moment at the track. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing we wanted to show. I mean, we did want to get away from the track every once in a while, the little levity of the playing golf and so forth. Yeah. But yeah, that was probably the reason why.
Interesting. I mean, I actually want to ask you about Dale, because he seems to be somewhat at odds with the name of the horse that he's training. He's a rather stiff sometimes human being, except for this golf game. He goes to get his clothes fitted, and he wants the idiots to go, his friends who he calls the idiots, to go out. But it seemed to me that you may have experienced some issues in terms of getting his trust, because he was very guarded, even when there's that other trainer there and his son is right there in front of him, and he's just really removed and very obdurate in a certain way. And I wanted to ask you about how you gradually kind of got into that sort of scenario in terms of a golf game.
That's so funny that you're saying that, because he has an extremely dry sense of humor. I think that's what we showed. You know, everything he says is very dry. You know, that whole scene with him, it's just his personality. He kind of, and that's what we...
He's also a big guy and kind of imposing, so it kind of sets people off a little bit, but he is, he's probably one of the most open people that we had, and he was probably the easiest to get to know very quickly. Huh. It's interesting you say that, because he is a funny guy. The whole family is great, and he's actually very open.
Frank Amonte, by contrast, seems even more open. I mean, that's why I ask. Is it really just a matter of comparing him against Frank? Or?
Maybe.
I think you're right. I think Frank, you know, you're absolutely right. I'll take that back. Frank was we put a camera on Frank. John was actually following somebody else in the barn, and then he saw Frank and, you know, started talking to him and said, and then we had to change focus. And like, how can you not follow Frank? You know, I mean, Frank is a fantastic horseman and a fantastic character, you know, and he's straight out of a New York Central Casting, you know, and he opened up, you're right, he opened up right away to the camera.
Right. If you use Frank as the barometer, everyone's guarded, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this seemed to me quite interesting, going back to this notion of family in which we see many kids essentially speak in lieu of their trainers. I thought that was an interesting choice on your part, because then I'm watching this going, wow, these folks are really trying to keep up a presence. They must actually look good in front of this particular Derby crowd. And then on top of that, they have this whole family image. I think of, it's the Arkansas trainer, Holthus.
Bob Holthus,
who has his wife, who's wearing this garish white outfit, this almost genteel kind of appearance. And this was striking to me because it seemed very much that image was even more important in some cases than the actual training. And then you have this juxtaposed by Frank, who is very much a naturalistic sort of person, who is openly affectionate with his family by contrast to the other people. I mean, how much was look a part of this documentary? I mean, you know, you have to keep up the image in order to
No. I mean, Bonnie's a woman, like a lot of women we know, that just likes to look good. And she's got 100 hats in her,
calls it her costumes.
Right.
She
likes to go to the racetrack and dress up. I mean, if you saw Bob, her husband, Bob will probably wear this variation of the same thing every day. I mean, to someone like Bonnie, yeah, the racetrack's a celebration to her, and she wants to look good and et cetera, but...
Bonnie's also a hell of a handicapper, by the way.
Oh, really?
She's a great handicapper.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's just like any business. You know, there's some people that are slick talking businessmen, there are others that aren't. You know, it's you can compare it to any business where some feel that the out exterior is very important, where others don't.
Well, I mentioned this in light of what Frank says, of people saying, oh, you can't be scruffy, Frank, as he gets promoted from assistant trainer to head trainer. So this, to me, sort of suggested that this was a big concern on your part.
Yeah, well, not really a concern of ours, but it was interesting to see that, okay, now you've been the underling for 20 some odd years, and now you're the mouthpiece of this barn. So, yeah, there is media opportunities, and you know, it's if someone sees that you're, I guess, not scruffy anymore. I mean, maybe they lend more. Maybe they trust you to bring them their horses, or you get more business that way. I mean, it just depends how you look at. It's, I guess, the business acumen. Is that the correct way to say it? Of each of these people. I mean.
Yeah. Well, I suppose so. I also wanted to ask you about one aspect of this film. It was very astonishing to me that there was a lack of gambling in this. I mean, people go to the Kentucky Derby not just for the bourbon, as you point out near the end, but also because they want to win some money on these horses. Why not portray this particular aspect of horse racing? It seems an ineluctable element of what it means to actually...
Well, we did with Jake Roman. We thought it would be a funny way and a new, interesting way to show gambling at the racetrack when we have the 12-year-old gambling.
Yeah.
We just thought that was neat instead of showing maybe the same, you know, that was our best way to, you know, to show a gambling aspect was through a different set of eyes, a 12-year-old. You know, he bet a couple bucks here and there, but, you know, there are a lot, I mean,
there's so much we wanted to do.
We could have done, you know, we could have made the Criterion Collection version 3.5 hours, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's just tough. You just got to make some hard choices at the end of the day to get the best possible product out there, you know, and, you know, you have to be honest with yourself because you just don't want to bore people. We feel like the pacing this is really good, and that's what people say. It keeps them, you know, I'm sure you watch a lot of movies, and ones that drag in certain points, you're like, all right, enough. And, you know, we watched this enough and screened it with enough people where we thought it was dragging. We're just like, let's just get this out. You know?
But I'm wondering if there's a certain danger in dwelling too much on the pauses. I mean, is this intended to reflect life? Is this intended to reflect what it is to be a trainer? Or is this just a mere entertaining human interest story? Or can it be both?
This is a story about people that just happens to be set at the racetrack. It's about a lifestyle. It's about a world that people probably aren't familiar with. And it's a way of life to these folks. And just like any documentary, you know, what are you really doing in a documentary? You're exploring a world that you may not know that much about. Mm. And that's kind of what we wanted to do. We wanted to show, you know, this great world that, you know, we say horse racing is the greatest sport you're not paying attention to, and we wanted to give you a little taste of it. You know, if you see a documentary on yachting, I might say, you know what, or sailing. I don't know anything about sailing, but I just saw this great documentary that wet my whistle. I'm going to go sail, or, you know, so, and that's what we really wanted to do.
But, I mean, there's also an appeal in showing the tragic elements of a particular event that might also get people really interested in horse racing. So that's why I kind of asked the question about whether this is intended to reflect life or a particular kind of niche here, this horse racing idea. I mean, certainly.
I think it's, you know, it's you can say that it's about people going after the ultimate goal, you know, their ultimate goal in their life, whether that is in Hoop Dreams, it's making the NBA. It's in Spellbound, it's winning the National Spelling Bee. For these guys, it is winning the Kentucky Derby. I mean, there's only been about 190 trainers that have won the Derby altogether, maybe around 90.
Right.
For multiple winners. I don't know that stat. You guys can Google it. I don't know. But there's only been 90, and that's your part of history. You know, this is the pinnacle of your career. It's like running for president, you know, winning the World Series, the NBA, you know, winning the Indy 500. I mean, this is the top of the food chain. This is what this film just shows, this path and the heartbreak and you know, and the excitement. And that's why they call it the most exciting 2 minutes in sports.
One last question. I kind of wanted to ask you about the notion of what was your previous film experience? I didn't see anything in the IMDb. I mean, did you learn how to make this film did you learn filmmaking by making this film?
Yeah, I mean, we've been in the business for a while, in the quote-unquote entertainment business.
Be careful with that phrase.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, basically, we always knew we wanted to make a film. It, you know, started out being a PA, and then I worked as a creative director at the Independent Film Channel, doing on-air promos and branding, and at USA doing the same thing. And John, you...
Yeah, I worked as a PA in Hollywood and in development, and I worked at sports stations, and, you know, I worked as a, you know, under Brad as a producer of promos. We basically took all the elements of everything we learned and said, you know what, if you ever want to do something, this is the time to do it. And we didn't have a ton of camera experience. We both shot some weddings and everything, but, you know, we got these great cameras and just kind of figured it out. I mean, that's our advice to anybody out there, is get these cameras and just do it.
The hardest part is to start. You know, there's a lot of reasons why not to do it, because, hey, I don't shoot. And we didn't shoot because we're great shooters. We shot out of necessity because we didn't have any money. So, you know, that's kind of the way. We would just, it was grab a camera, a wireless mic, and put it on with these trainers and point it and hopefully hold it straight.
Well, if you didn't have any money, how did you manage to travel to so many areas of the nation where you had to keep track of all these trainers? I mean, kayak.com or what?
It's a little thing called a second mortgage. I mean, basically what we did is, you know, we went out there and we spent 9 months shooting on our own dime, and then we made a sales tape and showed some people what we were doing, and we got a little bit of money. So, you know, we had some really cool friends that wanted to invest, that they liked the racetrack and they saw what we were on to, and their names are Susan and Bruce Carusi. God bless them.
And also Aaron Schnell, Eugene Johns, and Steve Bell also helped out. And yeah, I mean, they believed in the story and they believed in the project. So it's you know, it's here Friday, April 18th in theaters, and it's hard to believe that it's going to be, you know, we started this film and it turned out better than we can possibly imagine, and we're excited about it.
Well, thank you both very much for taking the time out. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.